Hi, this is Tiffany the Last, and I'm in San Diego with Robert Fire. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
Robert has had a very full life, but today we are going to talk about his childhood and its part in the pre-World War II Kinder Transport. I've been doing a little reading, and I've heard some of your stories about the Kinder Transport, and that it was an immigration policy set up by England before World War II to help Jewish children leave, was it Austria and Germany?
And Czechoslovakia, I think, too.
What country were you born in?
In Austria, Vienna, Austria.
What kind of memories do you have of your life before you moved to England and were part of the Kinder Transport?
Well, I don't know that I remember that much. I think that I remember it, but it could be made-up memory. When I left Vienna, I was five. So I was a little young.
And that was, they let children from 5 to 17.
Actually, they let children, I found out, because I belonged to the Kinder Transport Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that they took children from 2.
Two to,
I believe, probably 16. I don't think if you were over 16, you couldn't get in.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the background is that the British government, I think the church sponsored it, but the British Parliament voted to accept 10,000 refugee children from, it wasn't occupied at the time, but from Germany, Austria, and I believe Czechoslovakia.
Uh-huh.
And I saw at the Holocaust Museum, they showed that some of the children from Czechoslovakia, they flew them to London. But most of the kids, like myself, left from Austria and Germany, and they came by train. I do have some memories, but I can't vouch that
uh-huh.
they are legit.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I remember when Hitler came into Vienna,
mm-hmm.
and I believe it was in 1938.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have been five, just because I turned five in August. And I forget the month that he came in. But when he came in, I remember I was very excited because all the bands and all the marching and the soldiers. Now, the question is, do I really remember or have I seen movies?
Yeah.
But somewhere in the background, I believe that I was very excited seeing all of these people in uniform coming into, taking over Austria.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I remember also, and I don't remember, my mother told me that I had friends in the German Hitler Youth, friends. They were older, and
uh-huh.
I would hang about with them and all of that. But that was when I was 4 years old.
Yeah.
So.
Do you remember from stories how your parents learned about it, and did any of your other siblings go with you?
Well, I have no other siblings.
Okay.
I'm an only child.
So your parents decided to send their five-year-old.
Well, actually what happened, when the Germans came into Austria in 1938, after Kristallnacht, which was, I don't know if you know about Kristallnacht, when the Germans went the Nazis went throughout Germany and they broke all of the synagogue windows
mm-hmm.
and wrote things, Jews forbidden and so
yeah.
forth. After that, when they came into Austria, they rounded up the men. And there are pictures you can see at the Holocaust Museum, and there are pictures that you can see in many museums, where you see old Jewish ladies, or 50, 60, 70-year-old, scrubbing the sidewalk with toothbrushes. And what they would do, they rounded up the men. And my father was taken to Dachau,
mm-hmm.
which is a concentration camp right near Munich. And when he came back from Dachau, and he was only there for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, at that time they didn't have a final solution. They just, I think, tried to scare the Jews. And my mother went to see Eichmann, the notorious Eichmann, with my father's sister. And they told...
Now, who's that? I'm sorry.
You don't know who Eichmann
is?
Eichmann was a war criminal, and he was... tracked down by the Israelis in Argentina and brought back to, and he stood trial in Israel in, I believe, in 1967.
Uh-huh.
But it might have been earlier. And he was sentenced to death. Israel does not have a death penalty, but in the case of people that have killed thousands. Uh-huh. And he was one of Hitler's henchmen, and he was responsible for the part of the Jewish problem. He was trying to solve the Jewish problem, help the Nazis get rid of the Jews. Oh. And he also had lived in Palestine in the German colony before the war, so he did speak a little Hebrew, and they went to see him. He was a petty official there. This was in 1939. Uh-huh. And she told Eichmann that my father was a World War I veteran and he had been in the front and so forth. So he gave permission to have him sent home after 3 weeks. My uncle, my aunt is my father's sister. Mm-hmm. Her husband, she kept him home. She never let him go out in the street, so he never went to any concentration mm-hmm. camp or anything like that. When my father came back from Dachau, he was told to report to the SA, which was like the SS, but another department, every week, and he was told that he would have to leave the country. And he did leave the country. He had a passport to go. He had a visa to go to Shanghai, but he went illegally to Palestine.
Okay.
And this was early in 1939, April, May. And that left me and my mother alone with her father. I don't think he lived with us, but her father lived there. And the story she tells me is that she told her father that he would he be willing to keep Robert with him, and she could go join her husband in, and then after the war, after mm-hmm. they didn't know about the war, but then afterwards they'd get together. And he said, he probably indirectly saved my life, because he said, he'll be the death of me if you leave that kid with me. So she probably had to find another way of getting me, because she could not leave with me. A lot of Jews could not take their kids with them. But anyway, he had to leave, and she then must have looked around to see how she could get me out of the country. And she must have come across the refugee program, which was the parliament, I think, passed it in 1939, and to accept 10,000 kids. And I think there were actually 9,600. They were not all Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
I think 9,300 of them were Jews, 300 were not Jews. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Yeah.
And then after she got me off, she managed to get away herself. After the war started in 1939 and early 1940, she went on the Danube to the Black Sea and was in the Black Sea stranded for 3 months mm-hmm. because it was frozen there. And then from there she went to Palestine and joined my father, who when he first came to Palestine, he was put into a camp, an internment camp, not a concentration uh-huh. camp, but by the British. And so many Jews were coming in that the internment camps were overflowing. So first in, first out, they let them out. And he was working already. And then when my mother came in, she was put in an internment camp because she came in illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started living together, and that's it.
And did your grandfather also
live? No, he died in Theresienstadt. The Germans were very meticulous in how they kept records. And he died in 1943 in Theresienstadt. They said that he died of a heart attack or mm-hmm. something. So if he really died of a heart attack or if he was gassed, mm-hmm. I don't think we know.
Yeah. So when you got to England, what was your first stop?
I remember being put in the train.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting because many years later I went on a business trip. When I say many years later, this was back about 20 years ago, 25 years ago. I went on a business trip to Munich. And I took the train from from Vienna to Munich, mm-hmm. which was the same train, maybe not the same compartment, but it was the same train. And you have a corridor running down the train, and then you have the compartments. And we would be in the compartments, and I remember we would run to the end of the corridor, to the from the compartment to the corridor, look out the window, and the parents were all standing out there and waving to their kids, and you'd wave. And then the SS or the police would be walking down the corridor, and we'd scurry back into the compartment and then run back out and so forth. So, and that train went to Munich, and then it went on to Holland, and then it went to France, and then from France we took a ship across. I don't remember the ship. I don't remember that. I remember landing in London, coming to London to a movie theater. They brought us into a big, huge movie theater, and I was so happy. I thought I was going to see a movie, but they sat us down, and my mother's cousin, Selma, who was in London, came, and she met me there, said hello, and we're talking German, of course, and what the movie theater was, it was really a big holding place for all of the refugees that came off the ships, and they gave us milk and cookies and biscuits and so forth, and then they put me on a train, because I was destined to go to Scotland, to Edinburgh, to live with a Christian Science family called the Foleys. So they put me on a train, and it was an overnight train, a midnight express. And I think I still remember it was the Blue Express or something like that. And they asked this kindly old gentleman who was a doctor to watch me, because I was five. And we went on the train to Edinburgh. Now, I remember that that's where I started crying, because up until then, you know, I thought it was having fun. You know, yeah, I was going on a vacation. And then all of a sudden I have this, Selma doesn't come with me, and I went on this train. And the next, I remember crying. I don't remember sleeping or not. I remember coming to Edinburgh, being picked up. I don't remember the details of being picked up. I was picked up by the Foleys. I remember how I was so scared. They took me on a double-decker bus and took me upstairs. They didn't have double-decker buses in Vienna. And here I am upstairs, and I am so scared because I think I'm so high up, I think this thing is going to topple over. That I remember. And then I lived with them, and they had a son named Kevin, Kevin Foley, and he was a little older than me. I was five, almost six. I got there in August, and in June or July, and in August I would have turned six. I think Kevin Foley was probably either a year or two older than me. And I lived with them for, I don't know, 6 months or a year. And I went to a school, John Glesby School. We used to have little badges with the motto, Fiddlers et Fortis, you know, and we'd go to school with our uniforms and, you know, typical English boys.
Your little caps.
Little caps and the whole thing. And I was... During recess, I would always be in charge of the Air Force, and I'd be, you know, we'd be running around outside, and I remember that. But obviously, we started learning English. That's where I first learned to ride a bike when I was six with Kevin Foley. It was an adult bike with the bars, and I would ride it with my, you know, where you put your legs in, under the bar, and I'd riding all over the place. And we lived just on the outskirts of Edinburgh. It was a private house, and it was very nice. And then from there, I moved to a temporary place for a short while, and then I moved in to with a Jewish family, the Coens, in Edinburgh, and that's where I went to James Glesby School.
Oh, okay.
And I was with the Coens for about 3 years.
Wow.
He was a furniture manufacturer, and they were an older couple. Older could be 50, or 60, or maybe even 40. I think they were in their 50s because they had quite a few sons that were in Northern Africa, stationed in Northern Africa. I know they had one son named Gordon, who they were in their 20s, and so they were an older couple. I lived with them. It was a very nice apartment in the city. I had a lot of friends. Went to the bathhouse and went to John Glesby School. Played in the back yard of this place. And this was 71 Spottiswood Street. Mm-hmm. That's where I brought Esther. And I brought her and I showed her 71 Spottiswood Street. And I looked in the back. I went, it kind of looks a little decrepit now. Mm-hmm. But then I said, well, we lived up there. And then I went downstairs and looked in the back where we used to play. And as a little kid, it seemed a lot bigger than it did to an adult.
Yeah.
But then I said, let me take you to the school where I used to do the Air Force. So I came to this guy. I said, this has to be the school. Looks like it. But it wasn't a school. So I walked in there and I asked him, I said, was this ever a school? And the guy looked at me and said, yeah, kind of prehistoric times. it was some office or something like that. He said, oh, yeah, a long time ago now. I was there, like I said, 20, 25 years ago, but that's almost 40 years since I had been a kid.
Yeah.
So I stayed with the Corns for about 3 years.
Would they take you to the synagogue? You could get back?
I don't remember ever going to the synagogue with them, never. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you in a couple of minutes, I'll tell you my first Jewish experience. After the Corns, and I don't know why, but I was, and I have to blame myself, I was not an easy kid to get along. And my grandfather knew what he was talking about when he said, don't take him away, don't leave him with me. So it must have been tough for the Corns. I'm sure I gave them a lot of headaches. I'll just give you one anecdote of what I did when I first came there. You look at this is a six and a half year old kid, and their son came home on leave, and he had the helmet and he had the rifle, he had things. So I put his helmet on, and I took his rifle, and I walked up and down the corridor saying "Heil Hitler."
Oh,
this is a British uniform. You know, they must have thought, "What do we have here, fifth columnist or something like that?" But you know, it's
yeah.
And I might have done that just for spite, who knows. But anyway, they put me in a home, a Christian hostel, which was on the outskirts of, which was in Linlithgow.
Uh-huh.
And in Linlithgow, in this Christian hostel, I was the only Jew there. And we celebrated Christmas, and it was wonderful. I was seven at the time. I was one of the, amongst the kids where there were some younger than myself, there were some older. I think the kids were somewhere in the ages between 7 and 10,
mm-hmm.
6 and 10. And they were mostly children of working Edinburghers, mm-hmm. people from Edinburgh that had, couldn't keep their kids at home because of the war, and they both, their mother and father were working, and they put them in this boarding school. And we were there, and I don't know how long I spent there, but it was very interesting. I think of it as a good experience. Mm-hmm. And somehow in all of this period, my parents were writing to me on aerograms from Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
They were in Palestine this time. And I would get a letter once every 2 or 3 weeks, and I would very seldom respond, you know, huh? Nice letter. It wasn't, so, which you know, as a parent now, I think, what a son of a gun this guy was. And one time I was called out of class, a telegram came saying, are you okay? Please acknowledge. And I signed it and went back into class, you know.
Well, anyway, you were young.
But they must have felt that I was going to, being raised almost like in a Protestant Christian mm-hmm. environment, that I should have some Jewish exposure. So they had me, and this was against the policy of the boarding school because they did not like to let kids leave to go to Edinburgh or anywhere else because they were afraid they would get sick, and when they came back, they'd get everyone sick, which is exactly what happened with me. Because for Passover, I went into Edinburgh to stay with the chief rabbi of Edinburgh, uh-huh. whose name was also Cohen, and he had no relationship with the other Cohen. And I was there for Passover. And that was my first Jewish experience, which was, you know, I couldn't understand it. They were praying so much, and I was hungry. And and then when I came back, I had the mumps.
Oh.
And I got every, and I was put into
a
separate area, so I wouldn't infect it. But that, I stayed there, and I don't remember how long. But then after that, they moved me to a Jewish hostel in Kirkcudbury, near Castle Douglas, which is in southern part of Scotland, just north of England. And I stayed there for, for a while. And then I went, then I was moved to another hostel in Glasgow for 6 months, right, I don't know if you know Glasgow.
No.
But it's right off of Sucky Hall Street on Hill Street. And I took Esther to this place, and I showed her where that was. And I went to primary school there. And then one summer, because they closed that hostel, they sent me to a farm school in, it was a Jewish farm school in Bonnyrigg, Scotland, outside of Edinburgh also. And I liked it. It was good. We would work out in the fields. Mm-hmm. We would have a lot of fruit, apple, plums, gooseberries, and all sorts of fruit like that. And I loved working there because I could eat most of the fruit while I was working. And then I was there for, and then they asked me, do you like? I said, yeah. I said, okay, we'll transfer you there. So they transferred me there. I stayed there, and then I went into town to go to the public school. So I was in primary school, and then I was in secondary school, sixth grade. And that was, the war had ended. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the war, we got a lot of kids from concentration camps that came in to our hostel. Mm-hmm. I was the youngest in this, in Poulton House, that was the name of the place. And I was the youngest kid in that place. I was 11, I think, 11 or 12. And all the other kids were anywhere from 13 to 18. And the kids that came in from the concentration camps who spoke no English were all 15 to 18 also. And that's how I learned a little German and Yiddish, because I had forgotten completely any German. And I learned a little Yiddish from these kids. And then in 1946, I was put on a ship to rejoin my parents in Palestine. And then I was like 12, 12 and a half. So it was 7 years from the time I left Austria to the time I rejoined my parents in Palestine in 1946. 2 years later, Palestine became Israel. But so that's it.
And how long did you live in Israel?
I lived in Israel from 46 to 57, till 1957.
And then you came to the United States.
I came to, I lived there from 46 to 57. I was in the Air Force from 50 to 55. And I volunteered. I joined up 2 weeks before my 17th birthday. If I'd waited another year, I would have been drafted anyway, because there's compulsory service. At that time, it was 2 years. I signed up for 5 years because I was becoming an airplane mechanic, and I went through the training and all of that. And I couldn't get into pilot training because I'm colorblind. I have a red-green deficiency. So that was the... So I was in the service for 5 years, still 55. And then I got out in 55, and I worked in a chemical factory for a short while. I got my high school degree in the Air Force, and then I came to the States to study in 57.
Are you, with all the world events that have come and gone since World War II, are you surprised when you hear of stories around the world where children become orphans or genocide takes place?
No, I'm not surprised. I'm a little saddened that we haven't learned anything. You have situations right now in Darfur, in Africa, where there's essentially a Holocaust going on. And we're all fat, dumb, and happy and living our lives. And, you know, so 100,000 get killed, a million get killed. It saddens me, and I think I was relatively lucky. I mean, I'm an only child, and most of the kids on the kinder transport lost their parents. I didn't. But the point is, what always amazes me is that there were 6 million Jews killed. There were 20 some odd million people killed. But life went on. People were still going to cocktail parties mm-hmm. and having fun and all of that in Germany, in America, and every, and hasn't changed. You still have Holocaust going on all over the world. I mean, right now there's a terrible situation in Iraq, having 100 Iraqis killed a day almost, mm-hmm. and that's only the ones we know about. And then you have we're, I think at this point, 3,100 Americans killed and maybe another 20 or 30,000 wounded and mm-hmm. seriously hurt. So, no, it doesn't surprise me.
You obviously know your geography and history, lived through so much. But when you were describing the Nazis and at the beginning and that they blamed the Jewish for World War I.
It was a scapegoat. They scapegoated the Jews. And the Jews were doing relatively well. That doesn't mean that 100% of Jews are well off.
No.
But there were some Jews that were doing quite well. There were Jewish bankers, but there were Christian bankers
yes.
too. And what they would do is if you had, let's say, 10 bankers and one was Jewish, they would point at that one and say, you see, he's screwing up the whole money system. Well, if he's screwing up, the other nine are screwing up too, but they picked on gypsies, they picked on Jews, and Hitler just managed to get the... What Hitler did in the... After World War I, Germany was kind of dealt a raw deal. They lost the war, and France and Britain, and maybe the United States too, they had what they call the Versailles Agreement. In the Versailles Agreement, they basically said Germany could not arm itself again. Germany would have to be in bad, bad economic straits. Well, at that time, there was a depression, if you remember. Well, you don't remember, nor do I. But in the 20s, there was a depression in the United States. Uh-huh. In Germany, there was a depression that was made the depression here look like good times.
Oh.
Because in Germany, you can look at stamps. There's a stamp that has one mark on it. 2 days later, that one mark stamp has a million marks on it.
Wow.
It's a million. A few days later, it's a billion. So can you imagine? It's like if you go and buy a piece of bread, cost you a dollar, and imagine you come to the store next week and it's $25 mm-hmm. for the piece of bread, and then all of a sudden it's $3,000. So they had hyperinflation. And then comes this guy who was a corporal in the First World War, Hitler, who writes a book, Mein Kampf, My Struggle. And he kind of blames the Jews for all of this. And he's giving them so much power. There's so few of them. How could they possibly manage to be doing all of this? But anyway, the Germans were in bad straits. And here he comes and he blames it on them. He starts rearming. When he became chancellor in 1933, and there was a lot of skullduggery of how he became chancellor, but that's history. He started rearming. He started building against the Versailles Treatment. And the Allies, the British, the Germans, they said, we won't do anything. We're just, we're kind of appeasing him and letting him build. And as he built this, the economy got better. Because mm-hmm. if you build tanks and you build planes, you put a lot of people to work. Mm-hmm. And unemployment goes down, and people, including Jews, said, hey, Hitler's doing a good job for the economy. He's getting us jobs. We didn't have jobs before. We now have a better standard of living. And then he took all of that goodwill and started saying, well, the thing that caused you to have such bad troubles were the Jews and the communists and mm-hmm. whatever. And he got this mania about the Jews. He said, Europe is going to rid itself of all the Jews. And the way we're going to do that, eventually they came up with a solution that they would gas them all.
Mm-hmm.
And they rounded them up, and they became very efficient at it, and they killed 6 million Jews.
Yeah, when I was doing a little research on this, I saw that they... It took them about 5 years to put in these anti-Jewish laws in Germany. But then the minute he came into Austria, overnight.
Oh, Austria was the most willing. If you want to compare it to a woman that is saying, I accept you as a lover, And then after she's made love to the guy many, many times, very willingly, she said, I was raped. Mm-hmm. And this is what Austria is saying. Austria is saying, well, we were occupied by the Germans. And that occupation was, you remember when they said, when we go into Iraq, we will be received with flowers and open arms. The Germans were received with flowers and open mm-hmm. arms by the Austrians.
Well, you remember it. You remember the excitement.
Well, it was a great amount of excitement. Now, it was not too much excitement for the Jews
no.
And some left-leaning politicians. But the vast majority of Austrians, they might deny it today. They might say, oh, we were taken over. But I think they were very anti-Semitic. And Hitler, by the way, was Austrian.
Mm-hmm.
He was Austrian. Himself, so anti-Semitism has never died
uh-huh.
down, and usually anti-Semitism or anti anything, but right now it's anti-immigrant here, mm-hmm. here down here, but it usually happens when the economy is not good. If you have a lot of unemployed people, they will always look for scapegoats,
mm-hmm.
and it's very hard to look for someone that's of your religion, that's white, that grew up in your neighborhood and is exactly like you to say it's his fault. Well, you can't. I mean, you can do it, but it doesn't make sense. But if you get someone with a different surname, if everybody in the street is Smith, mm-hmm. and then someone comes in and his name is Giuliani,
yeah.
okay, you know, it's the Italians. The Italians are the problem, or the Irish are the problem. So there was a lot of anti-immigrants or anti-Jews and anti whatever, and in Germany it's been that way for many years, and in Europe the pogroms, which were the Russian ways of the Russian Holocaust ways, where they got rid of the Jews and killed a lot of Jews, that happened in the 1800s. The Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492. At the time Columbus came here, they were expelled from Spain by Queen Elizabeth, by not Elizabeth, what's her name, the Spanish sovereign,
yeah,
and
Isabella, uh-huh.
yeah, and they were expelled, and then you had the Inquisition that lasted from the late 1400s to the 1700s,
mm-hmm.
and they were and then you had of course the Arabs were expelled, the Arabs took over, and so I mean. There's always been.
Yeah, there's always been this. And you living through it, having grandchildren who will have children, what to open their eyes or to help them understand how this can happen and always has happened. But it's an atrocity. It's terrible. It's not peaceful. It shouldn't. What kind of advice do you have for other people?
Well, I think you should consider everybody, no matter what their background, their color or their ethnicity, or they're human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And once you forget that, I heard the other day on the radio, someone said, it's very hard to be prejudiced when you look a little baby in the eye, even the baby's 2 years old, and to say, let's say you don't like blacks, you say, well, I hate blacks. This two-year-old has done nothing to you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a two-year-old Jew, I can't even tell if they're Jew, if they're
mm-hmm.
white. But I'm just saying that that it starts basically with adults, with the parents, and in the schools, and in the community. There are bad people in every group.
Mm-hmm.
There are bad Protestants. There are bad Catholics. There are bad Jews. There are bad Hispanics. There are bad whatever. And if you run into some black that has stolen from you, don't conclude that all blacks are bad.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Don't conclude that all. You don't say a woman was murdered and raped, and if it's a black man, everyone says, well, what do you expect of these guys? And if it's a white man, if a white Protestant, the conclusion is not, well, all Protestants
yeah.
are rapists and murderers. But that's what happens, and as when you start when you have minorities, it's easier. It's very hard to scapegoat a majority. You can't scapegoat
mm-hmm.
even bullies in school. if they run the school, it's very hard to scapegoat them. So they scapegoat the little kids, or this kid that wears glasses, mm-hmm. or the kid that is short, or the kid that has dark hair, or whatever. And basically, don't do it. Teach your kids not to do it, and don't do it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Robert, I really want to thank you for sharing your early childhood with us and the story of the Kinder Transport. And if anybody wants to learn more, of course, there's many books out there, but there's also a great documentary called My Knees Were Jumping, Remembering the Kinder Transport and other stories from that. So check that out. And would you mind giving a pirate R for Pirate Pods?
A what?
We do it at the end of our interviews, like a pirate impersonation or...
Arr.
Thank you, Robert.